Welcome to The Composter, a podcast for farmers and composters. I'm your host and fellow composter, Jane Murner Senecal. Join me in practical conversation between industry professionals and farmers with a passion for producing high-quality compost. We are going to dig deep into the science, technology, and art of compost production so that we as composters can help enliven the world's soils. In today's episode, we chat with Felicia Newman, the Director of Operations at Coast of Maine Compost. Coast of Maine makes a high-quality compost and many blends which are bagged and sold across the United States. I could tell from our conversation that Felicia is living her dream job. She has a background as a chemical engineer, but a deep love of farming. In addition to wearing many hats at Coast of Maine, Felicia runs a half-acre no-till market garden called Three Dog Farm, where she has an endless supply of good compost. I learned so much from talking with Felicia, and I'm sure you will too. Today's episode of The Composter is brought to you by BioCycle. Founded in 1960, BioCycle is the go-to resource on composting, organics recycling, anaerobic digestion and biogas, end product markets, policies and regulations, and community outreach and education. It's where I go to keep up with composting news. I have learned a tremendous amount by signing up for the BioCycle Connect, the twice-monthly free e-newsletter on BioCycle's website, biocycle.net. I highly recommend checking it out. This episode is also brought to you by ComTech. Today, more than ever, people are discovering the benefits of compost in gardens, landscapes, and agriculture. However, as composting awareness grows, so does consumer demand. As a result, commercial composters are seeking ways to increase year-round production while maintaining high levels of quality in their compost. For many, the solution is a better process. For over 25 years, ComTech has worked with scientists, agriculture experts, and customers to develop a four-step process that produces healthy, contaminant-free compost while optimizing commercial production efficiency. This process is known as shred, turn, screen, and separate. You can learn more about the ComTech process at comtechamericas.com/composterpodcast, and ComTech is with a K. While you're there, request a complimentary consultation to discover if the ComTech process is right for your commercial operation. On our farm, EarthCare Farm, screening used to be the bottleneck in our process. We now have a ComTech M2 Multistar screener, and it has made our composting process much more efficient. ComTech America is proud to support the Composter podcast and is ready to help you make the most of a great opportunity. And now, back to the show. Welcome to The Composter. I'm so excited to have you on. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
What's it like in Maine today?
It is warming up fast. It was chilly this morning, but I'm over at the plant, so that's inland a little bit, and that it's like it's got to be approaching 75, but it's very humid today, so we're all working up a good sweat.
Awesome, that Maine humidity, love it.
Yeah,
cool. So tell us a little bit about Coast of Maine and your role there, where it's located, the whole gist of the compost operation.
So I've been with the company for 9 years. When I originally started, it was one location. One manufacturing location that is in, it's called Down East Maine, but it's Eastern Maine. So I guess for people that aren't from Maine, that it would be considered Northern Maine. But if you're a Mainer, this isn't North. There's a lot more of the state north of here. And we have grown so much over the course of the last, 9 years that I've been here, that we actually have another facility that we purchased, I think it was a little bit more than 5 years ago, in Pennsylvania. So southwest of Philadelphia. And so that was to help because we couldn't manufacture to keep up with all the demand from our main location. So the Pennsylvania location is actually substantially larger than our main location. So that is our manufacturing locations. And most of our compost is made up here in Maine.
Okay. And what's your role there?
Oh, I'm the director of operations, but I wear and have worn many hats.
What's your day-to-day thing look like? Yeah. What are you doing? Are you at both facilities? Do you travel between the two?
Oh yeah. Sites? Yeah. So I am indeed in charge of manufacturing at both locations, all product quality. So that means inbound raw material purchasing, outbound finished product quality, bag design, regulatory stuff, whether that be bag labeling or, you know, DEP, EPA kind of stuff that all falls under my purview.
Great. Great. And are you mostly in Maine? I know your farm's in Maine, so you must kind of be there the most.
Yeah. I wish I was mostly in Maine.
Okay.
I basically split my time. So it makes for a hard time farming, particularly in the last few years with all the demand. So I've been on the road a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. Were you like us where the pandemic spawned a lot of gardeners getting compost and hard to keep up? Yeah. Hard to catch our breath.
Yeah. And that's really when I had to kind of step back from a lot of the other stuff that I do and all the hats that I wear and just focus on manufacturing at both locations to meet demand. So kind of our R&D stopped, you know, on pause, you know, and it just was, okay, let's take care of the customers that we've got with the products that we know we make very well and not worry about any R&D or new product releases until we get this under control.
Great. Catch your breath a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome.
So we're just kind of moving into that now.
Yeah. Did you notice a slowdown this year a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, we're the same, maybe a little bit more than last year in like unit sales. So we're kind of a growth company and have been for years. The whole history of the company is pretty impressive as far as sales growth year over year. So, but we invested in manufacturing capacity, like to the tune of millions of dollars, like bagging capacity, 2 years ago now. And once we kind of lined that out, that's when the manufacturing world at Coastal Maine kind of got under control.
Okay.
So sales continue to grow, but we invested to support that growth. And now it's all kind of catching up.
Yeah. That's awesome. Do you track how many yards you make a year? Cause I'm not sure if you do it in yards or tons.
Yes. And, our permit is for 15,000 yards in Maine. And we make less than that, but it's very dependent on what, of course, we make lobster compost at our Marion location. We do certainly also make composted cow manure as well, but we're kind of famous for our lobster compost. And the volume of that is completely dependent on the raw material volume that we can get our hands on. So that's the limiting factor. So it depends on, and we use pre-consumer lobster waste. So that's like if you are from a different state, because I don't even think there's red lobsters that exist in Maine, but like at this restaurant. But like if you go to a red lobster in a different state and you go in and you order a filleted lobster tail, it's very unlikely that they fillet that there. They buy that from lobster processing facilities prepackaged. So, and a variety of other things. So when you buy lobster tail, that is processed at a facility either usually in either New Brunswick or Maine and shipped to the restaurant. So we partner with those types of processors and take their processing waste. So that's pre-consumer waste. And it's usually really clean and you build a relationship with them over time. But it depends on what their orders are, how much waste they have. So like if they're shipping lots of fresh lobster, like live lobster, then we get very little waste. If that shifts and the market turns around for them and it's very consumer driven and tariffs and all that stuff. And like, they would process a bunch of meat and, you know, sell that. So there's kind of an ebb and flow depending on market demand.
Okay. I'm just going to clarify too, for people that aren't sure, like pre-consumer is that's like what a lot of composters are looking for. It's a lot cleaner.
Yeah.
And the post-consumer feedstocks have gone through those kitchens and cafeterias and often are contaminated with trash and litter. And you just have to be more thorough and specific about what comes out of that for our compost creators
so.
Out there. Yeah.
So if you can get a hold of pre-consumer waste that's consistent, that is ideal for somebody like us. For anybody and, really that's making compost.
And for the processors as well. So it's a definitely a win-win. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Great. And so what's your, I'm actually, I got to look at your compost cam earlier, which I love that. right on the Coast of Maine website, there's a compost camera. You can see the live action compost being made. But so I can see there, but can you describe your method of compost production?
Sure.
And you mentioned a little bit about your feedstocks, so maybe go into that a little bit more. And are they delivered? Do you pick things up? All that jazz.
So it's pretty interesting. What I've learned, because I also visit a lot of compost sites. And so we actually buy finished compost as well, depending on like, and I'm the gatekeeper for who
cool.
we would buy from. And so we're very, very specific about who we would buy from, whether that's finished compost or raw materials. And I think probably is worth mentioning in this venue that in my mind or our mind as Coast of Maine, I feel pretty safe to speak on behalf of the company on this one, is that there's two types of commercial composters. There's the business model where you get paid by whoever has something and wants to get rid of it. That's called a tip fee based.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's people like us who seek out relationships with producers that have a byproduct, like, you know, lobster waste from a processing facility, who seek business relationships long term, and we actually pay them for the material. Now, it's not a straight dollar for dollar, you know, dollar for pound kind of situation. Usually we do kickbacks for transportation because fuel is so high even before, you know, the most recent diesel situation. And so it changes the kind of expectation for finished product. We are seeking raw materials to get to a specific end point. And the other type of business model is to, like, they have to make something into compost and then sell whatever that is. And I think that is worth pointing out because in my mind, that sets us apart substantially.
Absolutely. For the farmers out there too, you can get a sense. Are they waste handlers that are happen to make compost?
Yes.
Or are they there to create a high quality compost? And for me, I always say, like, there's no waste part of my system. I'm not handling waste. I've got these resources that I'm making high quality compost. And
Precisely.
I feel like you guys are aligned like that as well.
Yeah.
And it's important for the farmers to understand that because it's two very different products.
Yes, very much so.
So you're making some compost. You're also purchasing some compost, it sounds like, and looking for those feedstocks.
Oh,
is that not did I not understand that right?
That's
okay.
True. Okay. No, that is true. And I forgot to answer your original question there of, like, on the compost we do make, like, what's our feedstocks and how do we put it together? So we actually have lobster, and sometimes there's crab in it, lobster and crab waste, but mostly lobster. And that is mixed with sawdust immediately, sawdust and planer softwood shavings.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of stabilizes the stank factor.
Kind of dries it out too, I'm sure.
Yeah,
and
absorbs all the
stink.
Juices and controls flies and does all, you know, that's actually the most intense part of the site. So we cut it with that controls, you know, the odors and the runoff and all that stuff. And then once we get an accumulation that's big enough to lay out a windrow, we will mix that. And one of the other local things for us is blueberry, like I think Washington County, Maine is might be the largest in the world, but certainly the largest in the United States. I'm not sure in North America. There's a section of Canada up in New Brunswick that has the highest blueberry, like wild blueberry harvesting. It's a really big business up here. And so the processing facilities that, like if you go to Dunkin' Donuts and order a blueberry muffin, those blueberries came, those are probably Maine wild blueberries, and they probably came from within 30 miles of our facility. So like the processing waste from, or the byproduct, like you said, we use, and the sugars in their waste or their byproduct stream actually helps kick off the compost windrows here, because the exothermic bacteria and the other bacteria that start decomposing love sugar. And so that kind of gives them a big boost right off the bat and gets our windrows heating up.
You have like and a little then, wine to start off the process. Yeah. Blueberry and wine.
Yeah. So we mix obviously lobster waste, sawdust shavings, and blueberry and cranberry processing byproducts. And so that's generally what our compost is here. And we have a great big windrow turner. So like it's a straddle turner. So we lay out big long rows. And it's kind of like a gigantic rototiller on a shaft that drives over the piles. And
how tall are those piles? Like 6 or 8 feet? I can't.
Yeah, they're not that tall. Yeah. They're like when you first lay them out, they might be 8 feet, but when you run the turner through that, like at the peak, but when you run the turner through them, it defines the size of the pile. So it's usually about 7 feet because it fluffs up to 8, and then as it decomposes, it shrinks.
Okay. Cool. How big is that facility, the one in down East Maine? How many acres do you know?
I don't know for sure. It's not very big. It's like six acres. The guys here do an absolutely amazing job with the square footage that we have.
Cool.
They're quite exceptional at it.
And it's pretty remote from what I could tell.
Yeah.
Is that true? Yeah.
There's you don't pass through here. Let's just put it that way. Like if you have to make it a destination.
Yeah. But so Portland is the headquarters, but that's not near this facility.
No.
Because Portland's pretty.
Four hours away.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Cool. Yeah. Oh, I'd love to check it out. It's very neat. I love to check out facilities too. It's my passion. Sweet. And so everything, it sounds like they're brought to you. You don't have like a collections sort of part of this.
Do I have that wrong? We have a really good relationship with a waste hauling operation that many years ago, like I said, we'd like to form partnerships with people, like other businesses. So there was already a waste hauler. He's wonderful, and his whole operation, all of his people, and he invested slowly over time in watertight roll-off containers.
So
we could move. Oh yeah, because you don't want a big juicy 3-day-old roll-off container of lobster waste running down the road like
no,
that.
You bad way
it's
to get some angry neighbors for sure.
Yeah.
So many things to think about like that. That's great to have that partnership because that's a lot of vehicles to maintain that is not on you guys now too.
It is. Yeah.
Yeah. Great. And so who are the main customers? It sounds like everything's bagged. Is that true?
It is. Everything is bagged. And we do sell a little bit of bulk out of our facility in Pennsylvania, but that it's mostly mulches. Like that was previously a mulch operation as well. So like that's the bulk that gets sold there. But in our like what we're known for is our bagged compost products.
It's a beautiful bag too.
Eric Hopkins is the main artist, like MAINE, the state that created that, and it's really wonderful art.
And so it's all sent to garden centers.
We don't sell to big box at all. Zero. Like that's part of our differentiation for independent garden centers. And we do sell into like True Value and Ace, because each one of those stores is individually owned. And so we are in their warehouses, and you can actually order. Usually there's like a ship to store function. If we're not in that location, you can ask for it, and they on their next delivery, if they're an Ace or a True Value, they can bring it in the bag quantities for in stock items. So
very cool. And is there an indoor bagging facility? For me, I struggle so much with moisture because we're outside, and I want to bag at a consistent moisture. So I have this small bagging barn, and it's very limiting for how much we can bag because of that. Do you have a huge indoor facility that you're bagging? I like can't envision what that looks like. I've never seen that before.
Yeah. So I'm not sure what kind of bagging equipment you have, but in our main, like state of Maine facility, we have what's called a manual bagger, which is a piece of equipment where like you have a preformed bag that has an open mouth at the top. And you hit a lever and it drops, like if it's a 1 cubic foot bag, it'll drop a cubic foot. And then somebody else has to take the top of that bag and put it through a sealer. And then we actually have a robot stacker that we installed maybe. And this facility is a little bit smaller, well, quite a bit smaller in Maine. And we do all the composting outdoors, but we do pH adjust all of our products. So like most of that is done with peat moss, and then we trim with lime.
Okay.
And so we actually have a bog local to here as well. So we can control our moisture a little bit with what peat moss we use.
Okay.
In Pennsylvania, which is a much larger facility, we have a huge building and three different lines, and it's two out of the three lines are all automated. So, I think we have six front end loaders down there.
Just bagging. That's cool.
Bagging. That's it. Yeah. Screening and bagging. And bagging.
That's neat. And are you bringing material back and forth from Maine to Pennsylvania, or are they very separate? Because it's a lot of trucking.
Yeah. We try not to. There are, like, if we run out of something in one place versus the other, we will move things back and forth. But one of my projects, when we purchased the Pennsylvania location, is how do you make what's in the bag the same at both facilities? So that's been that was one of my big projects, you know, 5 years ago. And so we work through that in both locations and try not to ship a lot between the sites. It's just, I mean, forget about cost. It's just inefficient.
Totally. It's not a really expensive product and a very expensive shipping thing.
So yes.
I'm always struggling. I haven't figured out how to bag beyond Rhode Island pretty much.
Yeah.
It's Rhode Island, Connecticut, and Mass that we're in. And
yes.
I have not figured out that transportation piece to make it efficient.
It's difficult. It's a lot. We, you know, depending on where our products go, sometimes up to like 40 or 50% of what people pay for is actually the transportation.
Totally. I see that for sure. Yeah. So, yeah. Sometimes people will, for us, want bulk, like 20 yards to, let's say, South Carolina or something. And the shipping is way more than the compost.
Especially on that scale. It's very, very difficult. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm hoping that our conversation will kind of create more good quality composters so we can all sell this regionally and not have to be shipping it to.
It would be great, especially for smaller farmers.
Yeah.
Getting high quality. I feel really bad because I have something of a conflict within myself because I have a farm. I'm a small farmer. I solo farm. I'm a market gardener. And I would love to be able to sell compost by the yard on like the 20-yard scale. But it just doesn't make sense for Coast of Maine Organic Products, the company, to do that. And so we don't serve the market sector that I, quite frankly, am the most passionate about because I'm a part of it very well because of that. and you have to be pretty dedicated. So we sell a lot of potting soil to certified mm-hmm. organic growers or even growers that aren't certified, because that's where most of the soil purchases that would be bagged like are. But we don't sell bulk at all.
I think it's a great model though for farmers that if you are a market farmer and you can make some high quality compost, maybe not thousands of yards, and the only mm-hmm. way to sell it really that way is to bag it like that for your community. I think it's a great it is somewhat perishable, but not like a head of lettuce. You know, it's a great way to add to your, just have a little varied income. I don't know. I'm excited about having more of the farmers having a high quality compost on site, plus the access to having, for me, I'm so spoiled here with these mountains of compost right next to my fields. Yes. Like, just bring me 20 yards to field A. So great. It's so great.
Yes, so, very much so. Yeah. I am also spoiled like that. I feel like I have, not only do I have the best ticket job you could have as a market farmer, but like I have really high quality compost that I use. So I'm very, very fortunate.
It's exciting stuff. It's awesome.
Hey, you all, Farmer Jesse here. The goal of No-Till Growers is to help produce and create valuable niche content like what you're listening to now. We create several different podcasts, from the Winter Growers podcast hosted by Clara Coleman to the Collaborative Farming podcast with host Jackson Rolette and many more. We produce videos at the No-Till Growers YouTube channel, including farm tours and crop-specific breakdowns. And our entire model is to create helpful, valuable farming content that is free and open to the public so anyone, anywhere can use it. So if you appreciate that and our work, or are simply enjoying this show, please consider signing up to be a patron at patreon.com/no-till growers. There are also other support options at no-till growers.com, or you can even purchase a copy of my book, The Living Soil Handbook, because when you purchase it directly from no-till growers.com specifically, the proceeds go to making you more amazing content like this. Okay, that's my spiel. Thanks, you all. Back to the show.
So what are the biggest challenges at Costa Mean's operation?
Transportation.
Okay.
It's not even that is at the very, very top.
Yeah. It's probably getting harder even.
The last 6 months have just been horrific. It's the same. It doesn't even matter what business you're in. Diesel, the cost of diesel touches everything. Mm-hmm. And this isn't specific to our business. It's trying to make sure you're charging correctly. Like, it's changing so fast and the inbound raw materials are increasing so fast. And then outbound transport, like it's really hard to know in an accounting system we're right on the cusp of between small and medium sized companies. We're just shy of 100 people.
Yeah.
And just keeping our arms around that has been just a struggle. And then you can't get quotes for anything because no contractor wants to quote anything because mm-hmm. it's changing all the time. And so it's been a challenge.
Have you had trouble getting supplies? I'm struggling getting peat moss, perlite, vermiculite, coir, everything that went into our blends. I'm like almost down to just compost. I have control over making compost. I'm like, oof. I imagine at the scale you're at, it's hard to source those things.
Yes. So peat moss, there's different reasons for challenges for each one of the ingredients that you just mentioned. The peat moss demand 2 years ago was through the roof. So all of the stores that every company had were sold because everybody was home gardening, and all the producers were like, oh my goodness, let's make everything that we possibly can to try, you know, to swallow as much of this business as we can. It's just what you do. Then last year, the peat harvest was horrific. Mm. So you had huge demand. And then horrific, like that used up all the stores, and then lots and lots of rain last year. And so in order to harvest peat moss, you need it to be pretty dry, or at least windows of dry weather. And so they couldn't harvest it. So demand was still up, harvest was way down, and all the businesses that sell peat moss had to make some really tough decisions. I don't blame any of them, but it was very hard to come by.
Yeah. We switched to Quar, one of our blends, and I spent...
How'd that 30... go for you?
It's definitely a different mixing process. That was a headache, the hydrating and the blend, the trying to blend it so it was smooth. And the shipping was $30,000 yep. for the cargo ship from Sri Lanka. Again, your pricing thing is right on. How do I figure out the price of... Mm-hmm. The raised bed mix blend now. And so it was a one-time thing, and now we're just going to wait for peat moss. And the peat moss comes from Maine. Ours comes from Maine as well, mm-hmm. which is like 4 hours away from us. The Quar was supposed to be more sustainable, but coming from Sri Lanka, I cannot imagine the carbon footprint is too much different.
Yeah, we would need another whole call to discuss my thoughts on peat harvest. carbon footprint versus Coir carbon footprint.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, none of them make me feel great inside. No, so, and then maybe we're going to get off too off topic if we start talking about Perlay and Vermiculite, because those are two also very different stories
of
why they're not available, but it's a struggle. So, are you aware, this is totally not on the questions I was going to ask you, but any aware of anything coming up that's like, we can feel good about and could have a good, eco footprint that could be a good blend material. No pressure.
When peat became scarce, mm-hmm. that became my, like I said, I wear all kinds of hats, and usually before I was named director of operations, like they couldn't really name me. Because I was one of my boss would probably cringe like saying this in an interview, but I was the crack fill, right? Like whatever was broken, and whatever dam was broken, like that was what I went and fixed. And so I still do that, even though like my title has changed, like it's still my job. So.
Problem solver. You're the problem solver.
Yeah. You know, sometimes that's called a project manager. Sometimes it's called something else, but like that's my role here. Hmm. And so last summer, when we struggled to get peat moss, we still had demand, right? For our product. So what do you do? How do you handle it? So, you know, the Europeans have already been working on this. And so they've been trying to use aged bark vines as, you know, a displacement for peat moss. And that's what they do when they make soils in the southern half of the country. You know, it's not cost effective to move hundreds of thousands of yards of peat moss from northern New Brunswick and Quebec down to Florida, for example, in order to mix soil. Yep. So, you know, I took a page out of their books, looked at what everybody was doing, and we were already working on peat displacement. And aged, you know, there's a whole industry in the southern half of the country around southern yellow pine. And there's like a paper industry based on that. And of course, lumber. So the bark is the byproduct. So it's the same principle as going after, you know, pre-consumer lobster waste in Maine. You go after a byproduct in another region that's a sustainable item. So, essentially compost that material, so the bark, and you can use the bark fines as a displacement for peat moss. And that is certainly poses its own set of idiosyncrasies, like the pH isn't the same and the water holding capacity isn't the same. So you have to make sure you adjust all your recipes to handle that. But, that's certainly what we did. And I was actually working on that before the peat situation, the crash, like the poor harvest last year.
Yeah. Huh. And you can get a consistent supply? Or is it?
Yep. Yeah. Okay. I mean, it's like anything, right? You gotta go negotiate with other businesses. You have to build relationships with people. You have to be consistent. Mm-hmm. So like one of the things is like, okay, so how do you get trucks? How do you move bulk stuff? How do you always guarantee that you have it? Well, you go build a relationship. And sometimes you got to buy it when you don't need it because mm-hmm. you need that truck to stay hauling year round, right? Like that, yeah. that happens.
Yeah.
So just-in-time inventory is a laughable request.
Yes. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. It has shifted so much in the just the last year. It's wild.
Yeah. Yeah. Very much so.
Okay. So that's cool. That's another challenge. We got found other challenges. I'm going to switch topics completely and just sure. what defines a high quality compost to you, which you know from as a grower and then also just being part of this Costa Maine operation.
Yeah. So this is a really interesting question. I saw that on the list. So it's actually not very different, but there are some nuances to bagging that are very specific. So what most people don't look at a pile of compost and say that is an agglomeration of living organisms and I have to manage those living organisms. That's not the typical, like the guy that's running the front end loader doesn't look at that pile like that, but that is that's how you have to handle it.
Yeah.
So if you have compost, so we're OMRI listed, which means that's Organic Material Review Institute. So they are essentially auditing to the National Organic Program Standards, which has essentially a set of rules that they make. But it is not for product quality. Those rules are for pathogen kill, yep. not product quality. And so one of the problems that you can run into is you can get, quote, finished compost, end quote. That does not mean that it's good compost from my perspective, from product quality. So it can still be very active. It can still be heating up. And it's met its pathogen kill requirements for temperature and turning. So there's a test called a Solvita maturity test. Mm-hmm. And there's a guy named Will Brinton, Dr. Will, he has his own lab in Southern Maine. And he developed this test that he's right into compost, which is wonderful. And it's basically these plates. There's two different plates. And they have essentially a color, they'll change colors over time. And one of them is for ammonia and the other is for CO2. And it's basically a respiration test for how active the microbes are in the given sample. And that is one of the tests that we use to decide whether or not we could bag a material.
Okay. What are the other tests? I'm so excited about this part.
Yeah. So that part, there's also a couple other things that we do. Like it depends on how compost is turned, like how it's handled. So it's a much softer approach if you use a front end loader, but it mm-hmm. also takes a lot longer. So if you have windrow turning with a straddle turner, which is a higher RPM, essentially you're roughly handling soil microbes. And again, most people don't think of like moving a pile of dirt, right? Because we're talking about loader operators here.
Yeah.
They're just moving some dirt around where you have to look at it as you're managing the microbes in the pile. And it's a stretch for a normal equipment operator to go there. But one of the things that we've done, and I'm not even sure if most of the people in our company even would know this, but we keep, after we designate that the compost is cured through time, turns, and Solvita maturity, we actually keep really big curing piles on purpose and have an inventory turn block, like a block plan. So we'll have, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 yard piles and we'll go first in, first out on those piles. So what ends up happening, and I haven't done this testing in a long time, but it's probably 7 or 8 years ago, I showed through laboratory testing at what's now called Earthfort, which is Soil Food Web before, that you can actually increase the fungal count of compost in the curing phase if you don't touch it. Mm-hmm. And so your ratio will go up, which you want. This is beneficial fungus, of course. And that way, so like one of the things that we did for like inventory purposes and inventory management and then product quality management is use these curing piles, not just for additional curing, but to increase that fungal count. I haven't done any lab work to support that in a long time because it's a lot of work to do and it costs a lot of money. So once I proved the principle, we just enacted that as a system company-wide.
Excellent. Excellent. Do you have a microscope? Do you check out these little guys under the scope?
I do have a microscope. Yeah. And I used to. The last few years have been
just running around here. Just catching up.
I feel like I'm on a giant slide and I can't see the end. It's been crazy. I mean, in a good way. So we've hired more people. We actually now, I am not the sole quality manager. There's a whole quality manager. There's now a purchasing manager. There's now like ops managers below me. So it's now going to be delegated to someone else, which is kind of sad to me because I love that work. But we probably will go back to that. We just haven't. Because we don't change raw materials either. That's the other thing. If the recipes were changing all the time and the compost sources were changing and the raw materials for those composts were changing, then that would become really important. But one of the flagship principles of our business is that we form these long-term relationships with the same suppliers. So they're secure and don't change.
Yeah. We've had times before we've had a supplier for 25 years and then something shifts and they move out of the state or something. And it makes it so hard. But it's awesome to have those relationships. I love that. Mm-hmm. You know? Great. So, are you also just checking so you have the Solvita test, you've got the earth fort test. For the compost quality.
Product quality is kind of a different ballgame. I was talking specifically about compost as a raw material, like finished compost as a raw material and ingredient in the mixes. But on finished product quality, meaning like, okay, so we have a Bar Harbor potting soil or a Quaddy blend lobster compost. And in the lobster compost is lobster compost, but also peat moss. It's to pH adjust. So all of those are blends. So we check pH conductivity, like so salts. Solvita, we do bioassays. Yeah. So a bioassay is, let's back up a little bit. One of the things composting, particularly when you're using animal manures, is to be concerned with persistent herbicides. And so for those that might not know, you could have a farmer that buys market hay or supplements with market hay, and that hay might come from a field that was sprayed with an herbicide that doesn't break down. So that would end up getting eaten by, let's say, the cow or the horse. The herbicide stays intact, goes through their system, comes out as manure, is still an intact chemical. And then we compost that, or potentially could compost that, and then people use our finished products. And so this has actually happened to a few different composters, and it always breaks my heart when it happens. It's the nightmare situation.
Yeah.
So as a commercial composter, like how do you protect yourself from that? Because that farmer didn't do that on purpose. Like we form these relationships with the farmers. Most of the time when I have a dairy that we use, I like to form relationships with dairies that handle their own hay. Mm-hmm. That's the easiest way to do it. Cause then, but there's always the chance that they supplement because they run out. That happens. Right. And then you can't control it. You can't believe it, it just is what it is. So we do what's called a bioassay. And people this probably should be in our frequently asked questions. People ask a lot, why don't you test for those chemicals? And the problem is that the chemical companies develop these constantly. And the list of persistent herbicides that are approved by the EPA is long, like too long. They're $300 or $400 a pop. And at the lab. So you'd spend thousands of dollars, and then they could have developed a different chemical structure that you're not testing for and have it slip by anyway.
Yeah.
So the easiest way to handle that, we've found, or at least for us, is to do bioassays, and we have them constantly in the lab. And what a bioassay is you take a given mix, and we use our finished products. You could, you know, there's different ways you could do it. But we essentially grow microgreens. And once you get in the habit with all these products, we've never actually seen it on some wood here, where we've had a problem with herbicide contamination, but you would be able to tell immediately in a tray of microgreens. And the reason we use that is it's such a quick turnaround. Like, you know, in days.
Yeah. You'd see yellowing and curled leaves and
it would impact germination or at least seedling vigor as soon as the seed germinates. And if it germinates at all. Yeah. And so we haven't seen that, thankfully, but that's how we protect from that.
This is actually one of the main reasons that we've started this podcast, is because there was so many of the no-till grower community farmers that bought compost that was contaminated with those persistent herbicides.
There's one of our competitors that it really broke my heart, because they're a great company. And I just thought, and this is actually what drove the whole system here of bioassay grow outs. And I mean, I spent thousands of dollars on, essentially, I have the same setup that most growers do. Yeah. I have 8 bulb T5s and I've got shelving. And I got 4 trays under every 8 bulb T5. And we just, every 10 days, we're throwing a new batch in. And, to the point where the people at work are sick of microgreens.
We're doing the same thing. And I do just pea shoots. I find they just germinate no matter the time of year. And they're, but my family's getting pretty sick of pea shoots. But it makes me feel better, sleep at night, you know? Mm-hmm. So yeah, we got to do that.
So that's anything, all the in-house testing. Okay. We also do third-party testing.
What labs do you like? I got my favorites. I'm sure you do too.
it's really interesting. So, I mean, we've used J.R. Peters. We use, originally we used a lot of, PSU, cause they have a compost lab. Mm-hmm. Because we're trying to go national with our brands, those two labs can't do everything that I need for regulatory testing for the fertilizer lines that we have. So there's some others, but mainly J.R. Peters and PSU.
Any management practices that you want to recommend to farmers and composters that want to make the highest quality compost when you're walking around your sites? You know, what are you looking for? What do you want people to know?
Weed seed control in your bulk piles. I mean, this is after you, so if you do a good job and you get your temperatures and you kill all the weed seeds that are in there, then you want to protect that, right? Mm-hmm. And I can tell you the boys at both plants don't like me very much when I say, get on the weed whackers and don't stop until it's done. But you have to keep an area around. It's no different than running a no-till garden plot. And keeping the weeds, like, you don't want to, if you're keeping your weed seeds under control in your top couple of inches, like, you need to have good, like, weed seed control around the plot. So it's exactly the same thing.
I am surprised at how many compost facilities I go to where there's like 6-foot high weeds around the site. It's very shocking.
Yes.
So that is, you're right. It takes someone like you with the eye knowing what the consumer's wanting. You do not want those weed seeds in your compost at the end, especially if you did such a good job
throughout
the process. That's great advice. Any resources that you recommend for composters out there? that have been helpful to you, or websites, anything like that?
It was pretty handy. I think there's a few more schools now, like class situations, especially in the last like 5 to 7 years. But the main state of Maine compost school is like a week long. It's not a full week. There's three or four days. That I think I started, and it just happened. They do it twice a year. They just started it back up again. They had it shut down for COVID. And that is actually a requirement for certain sectors of people in our company is to go attend that. Mm. So, I took it I think it was my second week on the job, like, no pressure. I was hired as the quality manager and I was, oh my God, you get a test at the end. I better pass. But that they actually do a wonderful job, there.
Anything else you wished I'd asked you that you want to tell us about Costa Maine or about your awesomeness?
So I don't know. It's probably the best job I've ever had.
That's so great. That's how everyone should feel.
I can tell you, if I ever leave Costa Maine, it will be only to work for myself. I won't leave. There's nothing. It's a pretty cool company. We get, you know, over the course of the last 9 years, I've sat around and the other thing. So, we also, you know, I'm not scared to say I'm 41 and I'm female and I am the director of operations.
And
I am part of the senior leadership team here. And so it's rare. You know, you get into some other, you know, gender stuff at work, right? Like there's no glass ceiling here, I guess is my point. So I feel really fortunate, and it's not just, I'm not just a token person at that table. I'm a key component of that group. I'm in charge of all manufacturing and product quality and that's purchasing. It's pretty cool. It's not that we don't have our share of 60-year-old white guys, but but there's also a 41-year-old woman at the table. So
sweet.
it's really I love working here. I'm very passionate about soils. I feel really fortunate to you know, what for me, my farm, like what is farm and what is Coast of Maine? But like my day job versus my you know, personal passion. And it's a pretty blurry line. You know, I'm going to leave here probably at 4 or 4:30 today. And then I'm going to seed out plugs, to do a peat trial for work. So, you know, am I working or am I farming?
Yeah. I'm like shocked at how similar we are. Actually, I'm also 41, also the head of this company.
And, that's great.
And I feel the same way. Like, I don't really, I couldn't even decipher between what's work and play at this point and what's for the farm, what's for just what I'd want to do for growing in my life.
Yeah.
So it's a beautiful thing. We didn't even get to talk about Three Dog Farm that much. I would love to hear more about that. But I think I might have to interview you again.
So, about the farm. That's pretty fun.
Absolutely.
Too,
yeah. And we're going to have to dig in next time about your chemical engineer background and all that stuff too, because you're pretty rad.
Yeah. So. Well, I feel so incredibly fortunate. Like, I never thought at 41, I would be essentially chasing manure or like food waste and farming and like slinging lettuce on Saturday mornings at the farmer's market and think like this was going to be my life. But I can't even fathom doing anything else. I feel very fortunate to have this cross section.
Well, you know, you're on the right path. That's so great. Well, thank you, Felicia, you've been so generous with your time. I appreciate you so much.
Yeah.
And
no
I'm
problem.
Sure we'll be talking again.
If you enjoyed hearing from Felicia Newman as much as I did, make sure to check out coastofmaine.com. This podcast was produced with the help from No-Till Growers. A massive thank you to Jackson Rowlett for his many podcasting skills, Farmer Jesse for his encouragement, and Michael Salas for his editing wizardry.
If you are like me and can't help bobbing your head when you hear that musical intro, check out Soul Shot at soulshot.net.